Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who was the U.S. Ambassador in Iraq at the time of the 90 invasion of Kuwait. He was there to turn out the lights in the embassy. He went on to serve in the Clinton administration in the National Security Council, on the Africa desk. He also worked in Europe on the Balkans Wars as a deputy to the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, and George Herbert Walker Bush, President 41, appointed him to be ambassador to Gabon and a couple of other African countries. And he basically came out of the woodwork because he was asked by Dick Cheney to go to Niger to check on a story that Saddam Hussein had been trying to buy uranium, yellow cake, from Niger. Wilson went there, said the story was bogus, and then when the president got caught with his 16 words in the State of the Union address, which were attributed to British sources, saying that Saddam was trying to buy this yellow cake, then Wilson went public in the New York Times, and then in out of spite, somebody or several persons in the White House leaked that Wilson's wife was a CIA operative, and that essentially destroyed her career and perhaps endangered her person. And that is a story that is perhaps the more than any that's chipping away at this edifice that President Bush is has brought truth and dignity to the White House. And it's beginning to look like this may be the story that undoes him, or at least undoes the illusion that he and his handlers have carefully crafted about his presidency. We'll also be talking to David Korn, who's the Washington editor for The Nation. He's written a book about Bush the Liar, The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. He'll be joining us. Let's now go to Ambassador Joe Wilson.
I'm speaking with Ambassador Wilson, who has had a long and distinguished career in the State Department, and you were ambassador, well, you're the last person to turn the lights out in Iraq and meet with Saddam Hussein before the first Gulf War. But could you give me a quick resume of your State Department career?
Sure. Well, prior to going to Baghdad, I'd served many years in Africa, including Niger, which now is on everybody's. Everybody now knows where Niger is. When I went there, I had to look it up on a map. I also served in Togo, South Africa, Burundi, and the Congo in Africa before going to Baghdad. After Baghdad, after we closed the embassy before the first Gulf War, President George H.W. Bush, also known as Bush 41, made me ambassador to the Gabonese Republic and to Sao Tome and Principe, which are two countries on the west coast of Africa right on the equator. Subsequent to that, I was political advisor to the Commander-in-Chief U.S. Armed Forces Europe, responsible for a lot of the diplomacy that went along with our deployment to former Yugoslavia and Bosnia. And then I was President Clinton's Senior Director for African Affairs at the National Security Council the year we took him to Africa for 11 days.
And just to go back to your experience in Baghdad in 91, you negotiated with Saddam face-to-face to save hostages and then turned out the lights. Did you go then to Kuwait and subsequently get interned, or how did you just get out?
Well, I was in Baghdad. What Saddam was doing after he invaded Kuwait was picking up American citizens and making them hostages. He made about 125 of them hostage. We hid about another 65 around our diplomatic housing where his thugs couldn't get at them, and ended up evacuating several thousand Americans and other foreigners from Iraq, both before their periods of internment and then afterwards, before they could get caught to be interned and then after they'd been released for those who had been caught. When I met with Saddam, it was 4 days after the invasion of Kuwait, so it was not at all clear at that time that hostage-taking was one of his tactics. My negotiation with him or my discussion with him centered on getting him out of Kuwait without our having to put the military in there to drive him out. And, in fact, as I used to say, the first line of my obituary used to read, the last American diplomat to have met with Saddam Hussein, it now reads, the husband of the CIA spy who was outed by her own government.
Well, this is a strange thing. You know, the relationship between 41 and 43, people are speculating that it's strained. It is extraordinary to think that he was prepared to break the China when people like Schwarzkopf, Scowcroft, his own father, suggested that this invasion of Iraq wasn't a good idea. Some of them in degrees of emphasis, but nevertheless, what is your understanding of why he is doing what he's doing? Because many people refer to this as faith-based foreign policy, and a senior State Department official recently referred to the Bush administration as relying on faith-based intelligence.
Well, among members of the first Bush administration who wrote articles saying this isn't quite the way you want to go were Brent Scowcroft, myself, and Jim Baker, and a number of others who spoke out, including Norman Schwarzkopf at one point. My sense on this is that after 9/11, the president was profoundly moved by the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But I believe that there were those around him who were really opportunistic in their approach to this. 3 or 4 days after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, people like Don Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz were sitting in meetings with the President of the United States and the National Security Council saying that this was an opportunity to go after Saddam Hussein and Iraq, even though we had no knowledge then and we have no knowledge now that he was involved in any way with 9/11. In fact, I think it's very clear that he wasn't. They then built an approach based on really lies. The weapons of mass destruction was never sufficient cause for invading, conquering, and occupying Iraq. I always believed, and I believe today, that the threat of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of Saddam Hussein merited a stiff international response. That response the president attained when he went up to the United Nations and got passage of Resolution 1441. Intrusive inspections were exactly the way to go. And in fact, when the president spoke in the State of the Union address and when Colin Powell later spoke at the United Nations, what they effectively said was, guess what, these weapons of mass destruction programs are being disrupted. Everybody read it another way, but anybody who does disarmament for a living will tell you that disruption is a significant measure of success. We never could convince ourselves of the ties to international terrorism because there weren't any. There were no operational ties to groups that would want to do us specific harm. Had we been able to discover those ties, the president would have done or should have done just as he did in Afghanistan, cite the Self-Defense Clause of the United Nations Charter and cite the American Patriot Act, which gave him full authority to act in our interests in response to people harboring terrorists. And then the third Johnny-come-lately rationale underpinning the war was the liberation of Iraqis. The problem with that, of course, is the Iraqis don't appear too liberated these days. They're not terribly grateful. And in fact, they think that we're occupying them, and to a certain extent, they're right. So you ask yourself, then, why did we do it? Was this, in fact, the second battle in the war on terrorism? Did we send Jessica Lynch to fight our war, or did we send her to fight somebody else's war, whether it was Ahmed Chalabi's, or whether it was a broader neoconservative agenda of redrawing the political map of the Middle East?
Well, without getting into emetopsychiatrics, perhaps the president felt he had something to prove, that the extent to which his father was lambasted about not going into Baghdad in 91, although in his book with Brent Scowcroft, he makes a very good case why he didn't. And in retrospect, it's a compelling case, frankly. The other aspect is that the prelude to the war served him incredibly politically well, because just prior to the midterm elections, he was able to put the Democrats totally on the defensive. And essentially, while they were whining about him acting too unilaterally, he said, okay, we'll have a vote. And so they had a vote on patriotism 2 weeks before the election. So is there, I'm trying to get a sense of how this thing could have benefited anybody, because it seems to be a monumental mistake, and it seems to be that we're digging the hole deeper. So the one thing you can say about this unequivocally is that it's George W. Bush's war.
Well, absolutely. But to take your questions one at a time, I believe the compelling case was not retrospectively proven accurate. It was accurate at the time it was written. And those who were lambasting President George H.W. Bush for not going to Baghdad were a very few. You can count them literally on two hands. Now, they happen to be the same 10 or a dozen people who are sitting in key positions of this current administration and who have driven this country to war. Indeed, I think you have to say this is George W. Bush's war. It is a mistake, I think, to think that that the blank check that the president believes he got from the Congress was in fact voted on by Congress with the idea of giving him the blank check to go to Baghdad. If you go back and you take a look at the debate at that time, what the president and his senior advisors were saying to the Congress was give us this so we will have a strong hand to negotiate at the United Nations. And again, I would go back and say the 1441 was a good resolution. It was useful to get an international consensus on disarming a tyrant like Saddam Hussein, who had already proven that he would use weapons of mass destruction and who had always harbored ambition to have weapons of mass destruction. So that part of it was a good thing. The problem was that the president was simply not going to stop there, that the president was bound and determined and his people were bound and determined that we were going to go to Baghdad and we were going to occupy Baghdad, and for what agenda. So it was not a weapons of mass destruction war. The lies to the Congress on weapons of mass destruction began when the president went up there and asked for the blank check. He told Congress he needed it to go to the United Nations, but that he would, in fact, consult with Congress and he would consult with the UN before he went and did anything, and he would only use war as a last resort. Well, in fact, he used war as a first resort.
Well, as I say, I've spoken to a lot of people who know Iraq, people who served in there, both in the State Department and the CIA, like Robert Baer, people that know the country and speak Arabic, as does Baer, like Graham Fuller, Yusuf Ibrahim, veteran of the New York Times. Everybody said before this war that it was going to be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat, and now it appears to be a quick victory followed by a quick defeat. So, I mean, unless I'm you know something that I don't know, it looks like this is just a monstrous mistake. And as much as it puts you in the situation where you may not support George Bush, but you don't want to see America driven out of the Middle East by a bunch of jihadis. So where's it going?
Well, I think you're right. It's been a terrible mistake. And those of us who were speaking like this before the war always said that we hoped that we were so wrong that we would never be invited back to another foreign policy debate ever. Unfortunately, guys like Bob Baer, Graham Fuller, and myself are being invited back. And I must say, we're trying to come up with something more positive or more constructive to say than "I told you so." Now, my own sense of this is now that we're in there, that we absolutely do need to achieve some measure of success, because I think our own stature as a global leader depends on it. And I would define success as being having the Iraqis really back on some sound footing before we leave, which means that we will have to summon the political will to stay there for a while. I also think in order for us to succeed in that, we really have to internationalize this as quickly as possible. And it doesn't mean that we cede authority, and it doesn't mean that everybody else gets benefits that we don't get. We're still going to pay a good share of this, and we're still going to have most of the responsibility. It's still going to be our show. But you want more flags in there because you want to be able to persuade the Iraqis that, in fact, this is a global effort at helping them in their time of need after 30 years of tyranny, three wars, and the shock and awe campaign that the Americans waged on them in the second Gulf War. The other thing I think we need to do is we need to obviously make a considerable amount of progress on the Arab-Israeli peace process, which has become an absolute disaster. This administration has been AWOL from that process virtually since it came to office. The idea that you achieve 98% of your way to a full solution and then you walk away from the table, and in the subsequent 3 years you have 800 Israelis and 2,200 Palestinians dead in an increasing cycle of violence, and violence of the most horrible kind. I mean, who can forget 19-year-old Palestinian girls wrapping dynamite around themselves to walk into cafes and kill 19-year-old Israeli girls? There's something fundamentally wrong with that picture. So we need to achieve really victory on two fronts, one in reconstructing Iraq and two in moving the peace process forward before we can ever hope to calm the fires that are raging throughout the Muslim world.
But there may be some basic reasons for this. I mean, the so-called neocons were around forever. I recall they had some influence during the Reagan administration, but they were essentially kept at bay. George Herbert Walker Bush didn't want to have anything to do with them and kept them at bay. Clinton kept them out, but in their wilderness, in their Siberia, they were sort of planning. And then George Bush opened the door, and they're all in key positions. And you get the impression that perhaps there's a way to explain this crazy thing, and that is that since there's a clear connection between the neocons, particularly Pearl and Doug Feith, both of whom work for Netanyahu, that they're, you know, somehow connected or in concert with the Likud in Israel, and it's clear that the Likud has a hardline approach to both the Palestinians, particularly the Palestinians, and the fact that we took the Iraqi army out of the equation almost seems like we were doing Israel a favor, because that was what they wanted, as opposed to, it was one of the dumbest things we ever did, because instead of having 400,000 guys keeping the peace, we have 400,000 armed, pissed-off guys who are bitter. So if this is the mess that appears to be, is there a cynical explanation to the extent to which maybe the hardliners like Sharon and Netanyahu like the idea of a destabilized Iraq that destabilizes the neighborhood? And if the Shia and the Sunni go at it, well, that's gravy.
Well, I think you're getting down to the essence of this. But first, on the technical question of sending the army home, we actually have had a fair amount of experience in reducing the size of militaries, particularly rebel militaries. We do it through the World Bank. We do it through other international organizations. We don't just send them home without something else to do. You end up sending an army home without pay, and they'll take their guns home and become a militia that'll come back at you later. So that was a terrible mistake on the part of the occupying forces. But you're absolutely right that the neoconservative movement is essentially a small band of zealots who have forged an alliance with a political party in Israel, the Likud party, for the purposes really of supporting Likud's vision of what their national security should look like in the out years. It's been articulated in a paper done by Richard Pearl in a study group in the mid-90s. Many of those people who signed that study group paper are now members of the administration. And it really argues for the destabilization of the entire region, the overthrow of a number of these regimes, beginning with Iraq and then moving through all the other ones in the neighborhood. The problem is, of course, what do you get in as a successor regime? Do you get compliant regimes, or do you get instability? Now, I think as you take a look at the reconstructed effort in Iraq, which has been abysmal so far, that you could be forgiven for concluding that, in fact, the Balkanization of Iraq is an acceptable outcome for those who are behind this. Now, remember, the whole idea of liberating and democratizing Iraq is something that came about very late in the debate, essentially to appeal, I think, to our human rights heartstrings. I don't think these guys give a damn about the liberation or the democratization of Iraqis or any other Arab people. I think that fundamentally they see that the future for the Middle East and for Israel in particular looks better if Israel is surrounded by demographic units that are no larger than it is, or not much larger than it is, and that those demographic units are so suspicious of each other, the Shia being suspicious of the Kurds and of the Sunni being suspicious of the Kurds and the Shia, that they'll spend all their time fighting each other and not forming a monolithic bloc against Israel, as they have for the past 30 or 40 years. That may be a legitimate outcome. It may well be that in the future that looks a lot better for stability in the Middle East. The problem I have with it is that particular theory has not been tested in debate. It's been a policy that's been implemented by the United States and by these neoconservatives at great cost in treasure and considerable cost to our military and to our armed forces. And yet it has not been even debated in the halls of Congress or amongst the American people. It has been by pretense, by false pretense, that we're implementing this policy under some other guise, the guise being weapons of mass destruction, ties to terrorism, and in liberation.
Well, but there's something counterintuitive about the idea. I mean, I understand that there's a sense, that an almost racist sense, that the Arabs can't get their act together, so you should encourage them not to. But so far, we've been essentially weakening secular regimes and emboldening religious fundamentalists. And I can't imagine why it could ever be in Israel's security interest to have Egypt taken and Jordan taken over by the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, if they've actually got a good deal with Egypt and a good deal with Jordan.
Well, I think the thinking is that even the zealots around them would be fighting moderates within their own societies, or counter-zealots or zealots from another from another perspective rather than fighting Israel. But I think you're right. I mean, it is counterintuitive. And certainly the notion that a democracy, a democratic Arabia, is going to be more pliable to dealing with Israel than the current cast of characters is also counterintuitive. At the end of the day, democratic leaders emerge from popular vote. And if anything, the Arab street is far more hostile to Israeli policies towards the Palestinian than the leaders that have been dealing with them for the last 20, 25 years.
Well, indeed, President Bush got an earful from a group of religious figures in Indonesia last week in his travels. But let's just let me remind the audience again, if I may. I'm speaking with Ambassador Wilson, who served this nation with distinction, only to find his wife's career destroyed by the very government that you served all those years. And I know it's put you in an awkward position. And I guess, well, it's not. It's more than awkward. It's got to be hurtful, enraging, and isn't there at the end of the day some fundamental danger that your wife has been put in? I mean, I can't. Somebody on television recently said, "Well, I guess she'll be planning her vacations more carefully." So, is there some sense that that your own government may have put your family's life in danger?
Well, certainly we're taking a good hard look at our own security arrangements because. Not because we think that a hostile intelligence service is going to come after her, but just because there are a lot of people who really hate the CIA and everything it stands for, and she becomes a symbol of that. I mean, after all, it wasn't that long ago that a sniper sat outside CIA headquarters and popped off a couple of agents. So we're concerned about that, clearly. But more to the point, we're concerned about American national security. At the end of the day, she was a national security asset working on problems associated with our own defense. Weapons of mass destruction, which in my judgment, the judgment of most people look at this, is the single most serious problem we face over the next decade. Somebody close to the White House or in the White House decided that their political agenda was more worth defending even at the expense of sacrificing a national security asset. And they did that because they didn't like the fact that I happened to step out and say that they were lying about certain fundamental facts that underpinned the decision to go to war. I might add that whoever it is who did that to my wife is still there. So in essence, he's still in a position, he or she is still in a position to do it again. So how many national security assets have to be exposed before the president begins to take this seriously? And this is one area where I really speak rather forcefully against the president of the United States himself, because I am frankly appalled at the relative nonchalance with which he has treated this problem.
Well, you were sent over there at the behest of the vice president, and then you then when the words in the State of the Union became an issue, you wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times, and subsequent to that, two people in the White House contacted six journalists, including Novak, who first went public. And apparently, is it possible? I mean, I know you don't want to answer these. You may not want to answer a hypothetical, but is it possible the very person who sent you, who got mad that you wrote the op-ed piece, ordered his minions to do it? Because the finger of suspicion is starting to point at Scooter Libby and John Hannon.
Well, I think the investigation will bear some of that out, and I have full confidence that the professionals will vigorously seek out who did this. I mean, at the end of the day, today it's my wife, tomorrow it could be them. So,
but isn't the question, it's like Henry IV, will someone rid me of this troublesome priest? Is that the question? That it's not the guy that actually dropped the dime, but the person who told him to drop the dime?
And actually, people I talk to say that if you have two White House or two senior administration officials calling six reporters, you had to have had a meeting beforehand to determine a strategy and make a decision. To a certain extent, I think you're probably right about the Henry IV quotation. And I certainly expected I gave my own government four and a half months to come clean on this Niger business by speaking anonymously for 3 months. Only to have people like Dr. Rice come out and materially misstate facts time and time again. When she came out in her Meet the Press interview and said, maybe somebody in the bowels of the agency knew, but nobody in my circle That was just a fundamental misstatement of fact, and that was later borne out when she said, gee, I had a couple of memos on this subject in my files, and I just forgot about them. I might remind your listeners that the National Security Council was established in order to keep track of events and nuclear missile type activities, nuclear weapons type programs. So for the National Security Advisor to have forgotten about that is really inconceivable to me. But nonetheless, I certainly expected when I wrote my piece that they would come after my credibility. But even in a bare-knuckle town like Washington, D.C., the idea of dragging one's wife like a schoolyard bully out into the public square to administer a beating because you weren't able to discredit her husband is something that is virtually unprecedented, and it offended Republicans as well as Democrats. I can tell you that the calls I've received from Republicans have been they've been just as indignant or more indignant than the Democrats who have called me.
Well, it's obviously petty and vindictive, but maybe there was a reason for it, and that is that that the White House have been caught with these inconsistencies between their claims and what the intelligence people knew. And the whole point about intelligence is this: it's supposed to provide the policy authorities with the unvarnished truth. Intelligence is something that if ideology gets into intelligence, that's the end of the Soviet Union. If you can't tell the difference between rhetoric and reality, you can't make policy. I mean, it's a fundamental line, isn't it? That's what makes intelligence people professionals, isn't it? That they tell the unvarnished truth.
Well, that's exactly right. And if you take a look at my particular case, my report was one of three reports that were brought back to our government from Niger, all three of which said this bit of information that you've got is just not accurate. There's nothing to this story. And yet those three reports were disregarded, and the bit of information that proved in the end to be a forgery ended up sitting on somebody's desk and ended up getting in the president's State of the Union address. Now, there's two possible reasons. One, the system failed. Or two, the truth did not fit the political decision that had already been made, whereas this falsehood did fit. So there was a decision made to really lie to the Congress before the debate, and rather than have the Congress debate issues of war and peace based upon a commonly accepted set of facts, just have them debate on trash that the administration sent up there. Now, I would point out that had the president or had his people decided they would use the truth instead of an absolute falsehood, then those 16 words would never have been in the State of the Union address. So when people accuse me of being partisan for having called my government to account, I think the question that they ought to ask themselves is, who betrayed the President of the United States? Was it the people who brought the truth back, or was it, in fact, the people who inserted a lie in the most important speech that he has to make in any given year?
Well, indeed, to go back to the notion that if a professional intelligence officer's job is to tell the truth, and if telling the truth gets the political authorities above him into trouble, therefore outing your wife and destroying her career may have been a signal to everybody to shut up.
Well, I argued from the very beginning that, in fact, I thought that the rational, however objectionable the decision was, to disclose the employment of my wife, it seemed to me that a rational objective would have been to discourage others from coming forward. You may recall that at that time there were a number of anonymous analysts who were speaking to the press off the record, and there were stories going around about Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby going out to the agency and pressuring the analysts to get different conclusions drawn up on the threat. I don't know if that was true or not, but it's certainly pretty clear to me that if you do what they did to my wife, then and you're somebody who's kind of mid-level career and you don't want to have that happen to your wife, you're just not going to say anything. Subsequently, in the Washington Post, there have been a number of articles which have cited White House sources as saying it was pure revenge and spite. Now, pure revenge and spite is not a real logical reason for a public servant being paid by the taxpayer to be the steward of American national security. In fact, it's just not just objectionable and possibly illegal, but I must say it's just beyond the pale.
Well, it's one of these strange stories, though, in the way that the way that the news cycle works and the Beltway works. After Novak outed your wife, there was a kind of lull, and nobody picked up on it. And then the story got life when George Tenet finally moved to took the issue to the Justice Department, and clearly Tenet must have been doing that because of pressure from below, because there's been a lot of criticism that he is too much. You know, I mean, first of all, he owes his continued job to George W. Bush after 9/11. In the real world, after such a catastrophe that hasn't happened since Pearl Harbor, one would have thought that the DCI would have had to step down, and he didn't. So I'm being conspiratorial, but maybe there's some kind of a deal there that the president kept him on. You know, it's better to, as Johnson said, it's better to have somebody inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. I don't know, but I don't want to put you on the spot here, but what's your feelings on the strange kind of meanderings of this story and the role of George Tenet?
Well, I think there's always ups and downs in one of these stories as information gets collected and then disseminated. In my case, in fact, I did not react to the Novak story initially because I didn't want to be seen to be giving it legs that it obviously didn't merit. It was only after the White House communications office and political office began pushing the story, which, while it may not be illegal to push the story, it was certainly slimy, and particularly in an administration that came to office promising to restore honor and dignity to the White House and to change the tone. I got calls the following weekend from reporters from all the different major networks saying that White House sources have been telling them that the real story was Wilson and his wife, as if we'd done some nefarious thing to the administration, and not the 16 words. And then finally, I got a call from a journalist telling me he had just gotten off the phone with Karl Rove, who had told him, quote, "Wilson's wife is fair game," unquote, leading him to the conclusion that the White House had basically decided that trashing my wife was a legitimate thing for them to be doing. I then went on national television on both NBC Nightly News and then subsequently on the Today program and said, gee, what they're doing might be a violation of the law. And then they shut up. It then took a while for the referral system to kick in. Now, if I understand it correctly, and I'm not a lawyer, but the CIA has to notify the FBI or the Justice Department that perhaps a crime has been committed. The Justice Department then sends the CIA a list of about 11 questions that need to be answered preparatory to their doing an investigation. Those questions were answered, and it was referred for investigation to the FBI. When that second letter from the CIA arrived, there was a leak from the Justice Department saying the referral had arrived. Now, once that got out in the open, then the whole question of my wife's employment was no longer hypothetical. Until that time, everybody spoke of it as, well, if what Novak asserted was true, then this might be a crime. After the CIA referred it, the CIA doesn't do this frivolously, so the assumption then is that my wife was an agent who would have been covered under the specific statute about preserving the discretion in her employment. At the same time that referral was made, somebody from the White House leaked to the Washington Post this 2x6, the fact that there were two senior administration officials who called six journalists and had mounted this campaign to discredit me by discrediting my wife.
Well, it's clearly, as I say, it should be. If it would have happened in the last administration, I guarantee you, it's a very strange thing that it hasn't really. I mean, I guess maybe it's on a slow burn. I don't know. You get the feeling that there should be more outrage, and I suspect that if there's not the kind of outrage that there should be in the public, I detect an outrage building inside the ranks of the intelligence professionals and in terms of the Pentagon professionals, not the civilians, but the soldiers. And I understand from what I hear from reports from friends who have family members in the services in Iraq that a lot of the boys and girls over there are feeling like they were had, that they're fighting a political war for somebody else's benefit, not for the country's benefit. I also hear from people inside the CIA that there is a great deal of distress and anger within their ranks about not just the treatment of your wife, but this notion of faith-based intelligence. So is it possible that the real people who are going to keep this story alive and try and bring about some justice here, or at least get stuff out in the open, will be the intelligence and military professionals?
Well, I think what's going to happen is that once these investigators finish their investigation, they will either impanel a grand jury or not, and that will be another key decision-making moment for the political process. Once the grand jury is impaneled, then you have the flow of information and testimony, and we'll see where that goes. But I think that it's important to understand that there is, in fact, more than just a slow burn going on. The intelligence community has demonstrated that it's not going to be had in this. A number of former intelligence professionals testified in front of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee yesterday, and again this morning in front of the Democratic Steering Committee. I've heard from a number of both Republican and Democratic senators about their outrage on this. You've certainly heard Senators Hagel and Senator Lugar admonish the president to get his act together. You're seeing the Senate rebelling at some of the things that the administration wants to do, ranging from the $10 billion loan versus grant on reconstruction aid for Iraq to the easing of the travel restrictions on Cuba. So I think with every time that the Senate and the House goes back to the districts, they're hearing from their citizens that they've had about enough of this crap, and justifiably so. This is an administration that that really doesn't reflect what it ran on when it ran for office. I mean, remember President Bush's foreign policy speech at the Reagan Library here in Southern California, for example. He promised a humble foreign policy. He eschewed nation building and said we would work in a multilateral fashion. And, of course, Republicans have traditionally been the party of fiscal conservatism. And now look what they've done in office. They've taken us into an unnecessary war. They've got 130,000 targets for international terrorists where there were none before. They're spending just the most recent $87 billion in Iraq on nation-building exercises. They have made us, frankly, less safe rather than more safe in our war on terrorism. And they've taken a $5 trillion projected surplus and turned it into a $2 or $3 trillion projected deficit at a time when the baby boom population is about to make its call on Social Security.
But the one thing that they also won't do is they won't allow a special prosecutor, and because they control the House and the Senate, you know, you don't have subpoena power unless, you know, that's how they were able to hound Clinton, because they had the control of subpoena power. The Democrats, until they take back the House and the Senate, if and when that happens, there basically isn't much of a chance of any inquiry. So, in other words, are you saying that the only chance is not a Senate or a House inquiry, not a special prosecutor, but what?
Well, I think the executive branch would be well advised to do what it needs to do to ensure that there's not even the perception of a conflict of interest in this particular inquiry. I feel that my sense is that the Democrats are not going to walk away from this, nor should they. This is a national security issue. It's a breach of trust between the clandestine service and the government that sends it to defend our national security. The sort of shenanigans that are going on within the Republican Party, I think, are splitting the Republican Party, in fact, and will split it even more if Americans begin to focus and understand what's going on, the extent to which the Republican Party is dominated by a very narrow base of that particular party. Americans will get angry. And this will play out, if it doesn't play out in a judicial system or a special prosecution, hopefully it will play out at the election.
Just in closing, Ambassador Wilson, the leaking and the destruction it's done to your wife appears to be not just a tradition in Washington, but it appears to be a sort of time honored political practice, and it happens at at all levels. And now we have this extraordinary situation where this Secretary of Defense, a private memo about the war on terrorism, has been leaked. At a time when there's some friction between him and the White House, and suggestions that he's been taken out of the loop, it must say, to my mind, it looks like that Don Rumsfeld leaked his own memo.
Well, I don't know who leaked it. It's a very interesting memorandum, and people are trying to digest exactly what it is he's trying to get at, or the memo's trying to get at. It's clearly this recognition that Iraq is not nearly as rosy as the president's public relations offensive last week, just last week, would have had us believe. I think undermines the credibility of the administration even more. Now, I don't know who in the Defense Department leaked it. I'm not exactly sure why Don Rumsfeld felt compelled to write it the way he did. He perhaps regrets that now, or perhaps not, as you say, if he leaked it himself. But they're playing. There's a lot of hardball being played. I would say just one thing about the leaking of my wife's name. Leaking of information is, in fact, a widespread practice, and Lord knows the Democrats, when we were in the White House, did it a lot. It is unprecedented, however, to be leaking for a government official to leak the name of a national security asset out into the press. That is unprecedented.
For tawdry, petty, vindictive, childish reasons.
Well, absolutely. I mean, quite possibly illegal. we should not forget that. But it is for an administration that prided itself on wanting to change the tone and restoring dignity and honor, this is just beyond the pale. And it's not just the leaking of the name, but it's what the White House Communications and Political Office did afterwards for several days until they realized that they might be engaged in illegal activity. They were actively pushing the story on the press. Now, I think, frankly, they just decided they couldn't discredit me alone. I have a reasonably distinguished career behind me. I was George H.W. Bush's ambassador to African countries. It was hard for them to discredit me. And so as a consequence, they tried to make up some nefarious conspiracy between my wife and myself. And in order to do that, they've just dug themselves deeper into a hole.
Well, just a last thought, though. I mean, at the time, sometimes I think of James Carville's expression and reinventing it. It's the stupidity stupid. I mean, it seems to me that the getting yellow cake from Niger, if Saddam were in fact doing it, I mean, I understand he already had 512 metric tons of the stuff sitting in Iraq. I mean, in other words, what could you do with yellow cake? Anyway, it's just that I sometimes think that this country's lost a lot, both in the terms of the political debate, in terms of having men of stature in the Senate and in the House that can ask the tough questions, having journalists can ask the tough questions. I mean, I think one of the reasons the Bush administration's got away with this nonsense is that there's been a dumbing down of the process. The fact that I don't think anybody in the press ever said, well, wait a minute, you know, the emperor has no clothes in terms of yellow caked in the first place.
Well, I think that's fair to say. I guess I would make the argument that after 9/11, there was a sense that perhaps we really were under siege and that we did, in fact, suspend disbelief in order to support the president in his capacity as protector in chief. And then, of course, Colin Powell has such enormous credibility with the American people and always has. So I think there was a tendency to believe anything that he would say. The question, of course, arises is why did he allow himself to be duped the way he did after a long and illustrious career? I think it's rather sad to see the depths to which he has fallen in order to keep his position as Secretary of State, that he becomes a factotum for an administration that doesn't reflect the broad Republican Party. And let me say this. I am not being partisan when I say this, because I was just as proud to serve George H.W. Bush in Baghdad as I was to serve Bill Clinton in the White House. But I think the administration that you have now is not your basic Republican administration. It is an administration that is driven by some parasites who have found the Republican Party to be the host under which they can attach themselves to wield their mischievous ways. And that's this neoconservative movement that has formed this unholy alliance with the radical right and the extremist elements of the Republican Party.
Well, and you're referring to the radical Christian right in terms of Christian Zionism, is that?
That's correct. Those who believe that we really should provoke Armageddon in order to arrive at their belief in the literal interpretation of the Book of Revelations, the rapturing, as they call it.
But isn't that a fundamental conflict of interest? If you are the President of the United States with your finger on the nuclear button in charge of protecting and defending the United States, you cannot have an investment in the end of the world as a belief system.
Well, I certainly would believe that to be the case. I also find it an unusual coalition amongst the Likud party and the religious right, because after all, if their interpretation of Revelations is accurate, it's not going to be a good day for the Jews.
Well, on that note, I thank you very much for joining us, Ambassador Joe Wilson.
That's a great pleasure.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Ambassador Joe Wilson, who his wife was out and by the White House, and there is obviously a continuing inquiry into what happened there and who did it, and it looks like the finger of suspicion points more and more at Dick Cheney, who gave the orders to his minions, Scooter Libby and John Hanna, to drop a dime on this a woman who had served the United States government and whose career has been ruined, and perhaps her life's been placed in danger as a result of this petty vindictive act on the part of the White House. So we're, and of course we just ended on the note of Armageddon. And of course that is, let's face it, the world is under assault from all kinds of unholy alliances of fundamentalists. The Saudi Wahhabis running around the world, spreading their poison through their madrasas, creating people like bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda soldiers, the unpopular mullahs who rule Iran, and here we have the Christian Coalition here in this country who want to create a theocracy, Robinson, Falwell, etc. They are the core supporters of President Bush. You know, the thing that astounds me about the Democratic Party is why it can't get its act together and point out to the American people that this is a radical government that we have here that is in the pocket of these crazy people who, of course, they don't care about the environment. It's all going to end in the rapture, you know. They don't, you know, I mean, it's insane. And they're in, you know, and we've also got the wackos with the settler movement in Israel that are ultra-fundamentalists that are perpetuating that pointless agony there. So really, religious fundamentalism is a curse. And let's hope that somebody out there can tie Bush to the problem, not the solution. You can't fight a global war on terror if you're in bed with fundamentalists at home. We're going to be joined in a moment by David Korn, and we're going to talk to him about his new book. We're going into the lying mode here. David Korn's new book, The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. Let's now go to David Korn. Is he lying to us or is he lying to himself?
Well, that's the question that I get in the conclusion, which is not on the website bushwise.com, in which people actually have to buy the book in order to read. Because I sort of boil down the question to this. Is he a believer or is he a deceiver? And at one level, it doesn't matter because the results are the same. We still end up with this, you know, with the same foreign policy and the same Iraq invasion and occupation, whether, you know, Bush truly believed there were massive stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons in Iraq, or whether he, you know, saw the intelligence that indicated that it wasn't a clear case, but he decided to speak about it in melodramatic and stark terms in order to sway the public behind his policy. I mean, whether he is trying actively to give us half-truths or selective truths or untruths to win his way, or whether he is sort of misleading himself in order to, you know, fit within his own biases and parameters, the results end up being the same. Now, having said that, I think it's a pretty fair assumption or a pretty fair way to describe the president as a person who is a binary thinker. He sees things, he likes to see the world in clear-cut terms, black and white, us versus them, you know, freedom versus non-freedom. During the 2000 campaign, he was asked if there was anything he wasn't very good at, and he said, well, I'm not very good at reading, you know, a 500-page book on policy or philosophy. I mean, he doesn't get intrigued with the nuances and intricacies of life and of policy. I mean, there's one instance where he seems to have done so. That was the stem cell decision early in his presidency. He ended up lying about that, too, which is a whole chapter of my book, and I won't go into it now. But, you know, he tends to sort of want to see things in the stark black and white terms. And it seems to me when you do that, there are two possible consequences. One is that you distort reality as you absorb it. So you look at the world and you make it fit into your black and white, you know, simplistic view of things. So therefore, everybody who's anti-American out there, bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, obviously have to be in league with one another because that's, you know, the world is bipolar. It's us versus them. You can't have different you know, different sets of us, all the us's have to be together. There's that. Or if you're trying to describe the world in those terms, then on the as you describe reality, or your version of reality to the public, you then kind of distort the truth by putting it into stark black and white terms. You know, this is a war. War on terrorism is a war about freedom. You know, they hate us because we're free. No, I mean, listen, Bin Laden is a murderous, you know, evildoer, as the president has rightfully called him, but he's not attacking America because he dislikes the freedoms we enjoy here. He's attacking America because he has a maniacal view of establishing a theocracy throughout Arabia, and he looks at America, because it props up governments like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, as being an obstacle.
Right, but David, just on Friday, three veteran intelligence officers testified to a Senate panel pointing out that in the last 10 years, something like 16,000 people have died from terrorism. It is not a global threat. It is not any kind of threat to compare to surviving 40 years of the Cold War with nuclear weapons pointed at each other on a hair trigger that could have wiped the world out.
These guys have
turned Bin Laden into a vast cottage industry of paranoia.
The whole way of doing that is by declaring a war on terrorism rather than a war on Al-Qaeda. I mean, terrorism is a methodology. Al-Qaeda is a target. Mm-hmm. Now, I take the threat from Al-Qaeda quite seriously. My office is literally a block from the Capitol, and if that last plane was heading for the Capitol, it was heading for me. And so, I mean, it is a profound threat, but the threat is from a certain set of people. It's not a threat in terms of a methodology used. And by talking about, you know, this is a war on terrorism, and it's the forces that hate freedom versus the forces that love freedom. Indeed, you set up a comic book version of a war that can end up justifying almost anything because you haven't defined it in clear, limited terms. And that's, you know, and again, it's at the end of the day, it's unclear to me whether this has all been devised, you know, for, you know, cynical reasons, or if this kind of fits into, this is just the way Bush views the world. I think this, probably the answer is a bit of both, and that you probably have people in the administration who take a more of a cynical approach. But from Bush's perspective, it might be that this is just the way he's programmed in terms of how he's going to view the world.
But we have two choices then, David Coyne. Either he is a born-again who is placing this country, is recklessly endangering the United States and its security and its people and its place in the world because of a bizarre and quirky dogma and interpretation of the Book of Revelation, or he's a very cynical guy who...
I don't think it has to be, you know, because of the, you know, Book of Revelation. I think, you know, it could just be because he has a sheriff's mentality in terms of looking at the world and just sort of divides things into, you know, as I said earlier, into these black and white categories, and doesn't understand that, you know, sort of more, I hesitate to call it sophisticated because it's really not sophisticated. Doesn't have a more, you know, a deeper or more reality-based view of what's going on. And so I don't think it's, you know, it doesn't have to be because he's, you know, looking forward to the apocalypse coming one day, the way some born-again Christians are. It could well be that he, you know, he sees the attack on 9/11, and he sees Saddam Hussein out there. He knows Saddam is anti-American, and he just says, "Listen, you know, I'm not going to deal with, you know, with real risks or real assessments of threats. I'm just going to call everything, you know, the biggest threat we've ever faced, and just start clobbering them, and, you know, making the world do what I want, because that's, you know, that's his sheriff's mentality of dealing with threats, and often, you know, when you take that type of, you know, approach to the world, you can end up creating more threats and more dangers than you're actually stopping. And that was kind of the point of the Rumsfeld memo, in which he said we have no metrics for measuring whether we're winning or losing the war on terrorism, and perhaps the madrasas, those Islamic fundamental schools, are turning up more terrorists than we're killing. And if that's the case, you know, he wants to, I mean, his memo is really interesting. He says we need to find ways to try to moderate Islamic fundamentalism around the world. And I think that's sort of a root cause approach, which people like I, myself and others, have been talking about since 9/11. And the unfortunate thing is, while he says that in this confidential memo, he then stands behind General Blinken, who talks about this as a religious war, which can only give further ammunition to the right. Islamic fundamentalists and create more of the terrorists that we want to see less of. So it's really hard to figure out, I think, honestly, what is propelling and motivating Bush. We can make our best guesses, but we certainly can see that when it comes to talking about weapons of mass destruction and the link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, he was not honest and accurate with the American public. Whether he deluded himself, whether he was misled by the CIA, whether he allowed himself to be misled, he went to war on the wings of several misrepresentations or fabrications. And that is what those are the consequences we have to live with, and as a public we have to deal with, regardless of how or why Bush presented it that way.
Well, I think actually, just in closing, I think that Rumsfeld leaked that memo himself. But just to finish up on my final question on trying to figure out George W. and whether he's a blatant liar or it's self-deception and a part of a kind of belief system that just doesn't correlate with the real world. How do you explain the fact that the single biggest contributor to his entire political career turned out to be a mega crook who took the economy down for $400 billion, and yet this apparently he never knew that this guy was a bad egg at all this time? I mean, when I see George Bush out there looking like a blue-collar guy standing in front of a bunch of workers saying that he's trying to bring jobs, I mean, that's his mantra. But the reality is he's given away the store to his wealthy friends.
The encouraging thing is that when it comes to these two big issues that they got through greasing them to the hilt with lies, Iraq and his tax cuts, these are matters that the results of which cannot really be hidden from the American public. The public either has a sense that there are jobs out there for their friends and family who don't have them, or whether their own position is insecure or not. I mean, you can't hide that. That's a reality, and you can't hide the bodies that are coming back from Iraq and the fact that Paul Wolfowitz nearly got killed yesterday in a rocket attack on the hotel there in Baghdad. You can't hide these things. The public may decide they don't care. They may decide they don't. They care about other things more. They may just buy the White House spin that things aren't as bad as they might be. With Enron, you have this situation where Bush said in 2000 that he didn't know the guy until after the 1994 election, and that was just patently untrue because in that election he was one of Bush's biggest campaign funders, and as I broken the story earlier, in the 80s, Enron and Bush's oil company had done business together. It didn't prove that Bush knew Ken Lay at that point in time, but given how political Ken Lay was, it seems almost inconceivable that his company would be in a deal with the son of the vice president and that Ken Lay wouldn't know about it and wouldn't deal with it at the time, particularly when he had a relationship already back then with the vice president, George Bush the elder. And, of course, Lay himself had said many a time before he became a scandal figure that he had a relationship with George W. going back into the early mid-80s. So why Bush would even try to lie about when his relationship began with Lay, I can't fully explain. But nor can I explain a lot of the lies in the book. I mean, the book chronicles Bush from the campaign through the presidency. It looks at what he said about missile defense, Social Security, tax cuts, energy plan, global warming, Social Security, a lot of different things in which some lies are more sly and more subtle and easier to understand than others. When he talked on the campaign trail about being a tax cutter in Texas, it was understandable that he did that, and he didn't mention the fact that his tax cut plan also called for tax increases in sales tax, which disproportionately hurts poor income, low income, and poor folks. So, I mean, it's, you understand why he's not saying the full story there. Why he would say SAT scores went up in my state when actually they went down is kind of beyond me, because it's pretty easy to check, which I did, and I have the evidence in the book. So, you know, some lies are, you know, are fathomable. Others are not. And, you know, often it's a selective telling of the truth as opposed to an outright lie. But you put it all together, and it's really, you know, it's a strategic pattern of deception, and it got him into the White House, you know, one way or the other. It, you know, kept him somewhat popular as president, particularly after 9/11. And maybe the public will start seeing through some of this as they become disappointed in the economy and the occupation of Iraq. But I there's plenty of material out there for people to to throw at him, plenty of ammunition, and it's going to be very interesting to see what he does with his $200 million in the coming presidential campaign in terms of defending himself against this charge and the other charges that are justified and that are going to come his way.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, David Korn.
Thank you, and I encourage people to go to bushlies.com to get a taste of the book.
That's www.bushlies.com. Thanks a lot, David.
I thank Louis Vandenberg for the research and producing this program. I thank the engineer, Mark Maxwell.
This program can be heard on ianmasters.org on the net, ianmasters, one word, .org. Bye for now.